I am pleased to announce True Connections Radio is coming to UPRN 107.7 FM out of New Orleans at the Paranormal Radio Network. This is Catherine Buckaloo. Check out our archives at truthconnections.wordpress.com. Meanwhile, see you in October.
A time comes when silence is betrayal. Some of us who have already begun to break the silence of the night have found that the calling to speak is often a vocation of agony. But we must speak.
Truth Connections.
Tune in to the Mind Cemetery with your hosts, Chip and Nicole, every Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern.
Exclusively on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. We delve into UFOs, abductions, ghosts, aliens, conspiracies, and cryptozoology.
And how could you ever forget about those creepy topics you won't hear on your local news?
This is where I would insert my obligatory skeptical statement. The Mind Cemetery, where the paranoia about the paranormal comes to rest.
Follow us on Twitter and subscribe to us on Facebook. Also, check us out on our website, mindcemetery.com, for show updates and the critically acclaimed Mind Cemetery blog.
It's not critically acclaimed, but you should check it out anyway, mindcemetery.com.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and along with Joe Montaldo, we host News on the Flip Side. Come join us every Saturday night at 7 p.m. Central for our three-hour program. We have opinions on everything, and we're not afraid to share them. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news, but you can find it here with News on the Flip Side. Remember, don't be politically correct. Just be correct. Join us.
To UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
I'm Afternoon, whatever time it is, wherever you are. Welcome to the Citizen Sane Show. My name's Sasha Christie and my co-host is Guy Weddle. Tonight, our guest is Charles F. Rodley, who is a rocket scientist and software engineer. He's the Deputy CEO of International Space Development Hub, Technical Advisor for Stock Space Inc., and former Senior Software Engineer for Lockheed Martin. Hello, Charles.
Hello. Good evening. Good morning.
It's very good to have you on the show. Thank you for coming on. Well, what we're going to be talking about mainly tonight is the lunar elevator project that you're working on. Is that right?
Okay. Great.
So, do you want to tell us what it is before we start?
Sure. Yes, a topic dear to my heart, and I think it's important for a number of reasons. But it's a theoretical concept. It's only theoretical because nobody's built one, but it could be built with existing materials. So the idea is you might have heard of the space elevator.
Yeah, I did actually. I read about that a few years ago. I actually mistook what you were working on actually for that. But then when I looked at your CV and started looking into it, I thought, oh wow, this is not what
there's
I was.
There's a subtle difference. Yeah. So there's a bit. It's a sort of a spin-off of that. And I mean, the space elevator, the original idea, which was made famous by Arthur C. Clarke, but it was thought of by it was thought of independently by Jerome Pearson in the USA and Yuri Artsenov in Russia, completely independently. They both realized that if you have a geosynchronous satellite that's orbiting the Earth once every 24 hours, then you could extend the tether down from the satellite to the Earth, and it would be stationary with respect to the Earth's surface. So theoretically, if you had a material strong enough, you could climb up it and go to space, attach a lift or an elevator to the tether, and with electric motors run up and down. There are no materials commercially available that are strong enough and light enough for that today. Theoretically, carbon nanotubes would work for that, but right now nobody's been able to manufacture carbon nanotubes in big enough quantities. Mm-hmm. But on the moon, it's a lot easier, actually, because the moon is only 1/83 the size of the Earth in terms of the weight or the mass. And put it another way, the Earth is 83 times more massive than the moon. So the gravity field of the moon is very, very small by comparison. Mm. And you can put an elevator from the moon into space in certain directions. There are some restrictions to how it would work.
Mm. I was reading about poles or on the equator, is that right?
Right. The easiest way is to attach to the moon's equator, and the moon is a large satellite which orbits the Earth. As far as we know, it's the only natural satellite of the Earth, and it orbits the Earth once every 28 days, roughly once a month. And there is a point between the Earth and the moon where the gravities cancel out, and that's called the L1 Lagrange location, and it happens to be about closer to the moon than the Earth. It's about 40,000 miles from the lunar surface.
Is that so the gravity well?
And it's about 200,000 miles from the Earth. Now, it sounds a long way, but when you're actually at that point, you're weightless. But if you extend the tether, like a fishing line, let's say you unreel, you've got a sort of a spool with the fiber, and you reel it out and unreel it downwards towards the moon, then you can extend the tether and attach it to the lunar surface if you've got 40,000-50,000 miles of tether.
Right.
It is long, but once you've got that and attached to the lunar surface, then you can have an electric lift or a car or whatever you want to call it that would run up and down that tether to the lunar Lagrange point. It's a little more complicated than that because you do need a counterweight in the other direction. So you can't only have the tether going from the Lagrange point to the lunar surface. You have to have the tether extending in the opposite direction also towards the Earth. And that tether actually needs to be quite a bit longer, over 100,000 miles.
Wow.
So the total tether length is over 150,000 miles. Go ahead.
I was just wanting to clear something up. Is this like a static connection, like always connected, or is it something that you disconnect and reconnect and that sort of thing? Because you know, like every year the moon gets farther from the Earth. Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of like variables like that.
Yeah.
It's always connected. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, for this, there are a couple of different variations on the idea, but the basic idea is essentially static. But I qualify that to say that, I mean, it's a spool, and there will be some slack, as it were. You won't completely unreel the spool. There may be, you know, a thousand or a couple of thousand miles worth of tether still wrapped around the spool. So we can, you know, pay it out or reel it back in to compensate for variations in the moon's distance. Because the moon,
right.
Yes, it's even more complicated. You started to allude to some of the complexities. The distance of the moon does vary. The moon's orbit is not perfectly circular; it's slightly elliptical. So the distance of the Earth, of the moon from the Earth, will vary. So we will have to compensate for that. And also the distance of the Lagrange point from the moon to the Earth will vary slightly as well. So we have to have, it may need some very small rocket thrusters, perhaps a little ion drive to just very slightly nudge the station sitting at L1 just to keep it exactly on station. And yes, we will have to reel the cable in and out a little bit.
Now, will the cable
as well?
Like, will the main cable be located here on Earth?
To clarify, this is a lunar elevator, not the Earth elevator. So this,
I know
this
that,
particular
but...
elevator is not attached to the Earth at all.
It's anchored to the moon, but the tether comes down to the Earth guy, or, you know, will do.
Right. So the moon orbits the Earth once a month. Similarly, the Lagrange location, the equilibrium point, also orbits around the Earth once a month. So the entire assembly, the tether and everything, orbits the Earth once every 28 days. It's all stationary with respect to the moon, but the moon and the whole ball of wax does orbit the Earth, and so it's not stationary with respect to the Earth. But it's still. But the nice thing about that assembly is, although it sounds enormous, it's actually very doable with existing technology and existing materials. Over the last 10 years, some very impressive advances have been made in material science. And there are several new fiber materials now on the market which will work very well for this application. I can name some of them. There's one material called Xylon, which is made in Japan by a company called Toyobo. There's another material called Dyneema, which is made in the Netherlands, and I forget which company makes that. There's another material made in the USA by the DuPont company called N5. Just the letter M and the number 5, M5, which is a derivative of another material called Spectra 2. But M5 is stronger. And it's even possible to do it with Kevlar, actually. And Kevlar, you've probably heard, is used a lot in bulletproof vests.
Mm, yeah.
And even for sailing, it's used for ropes. And I think it's even used for sails on expensive sailing boats. So these are some of the materials, and these materials are not that expensive, actually. They're available in massive quantities, and the group I've been working with that's been studying this the most is a group called Liftport Group. It's a company based in the state of Washington in the USA, run by my good friend Michael Lane, who's the president. And the Liftport Group, and also our chief technical officer at Liftport is a gentleman called Marshall Eubanks. And Jerome Pearson did some detailed analysis of the design of the system, you know, the stresses and how much force it would be involved and how much weight would be involved
I think I took a look at that on the website. There was a lot of ratios going on, and I was absolutely lost.
Oh yeah, right. I had a stroke looking at that stuff, man.
I hope not. Jerome got a contract from NASA, and he did some preliminary calculations on his own in the 1970s. But then NASA paid him a little bit of money to do a study in 2005, so he was able to do some more number crunching. And the numbers look really good. And we're kind of surprised that NASA isn't really doing more with it. And I hope that's going to change. But what we did at NIPPORT was we took Jerome's work and we refined it a little bit. Because Jerome came up with a system that weighed a couple of thousand tons, but that's probably not going to work for the first generation. It's too big. But we figured out a design where we took a minimalist approach, and you can actually get Xylon thread from we baseline Xylon thread, and we actually talked to the Toyota company at their New York office, and they gave us some samples of the material, we figured that you could have an initial prototype lunar elevator could be built for about $800 million, which is cheap by aerospace standards.
Yeah.
and it would weigh about 11 tons.
That's not very much, is it?
Fiber materials. Mm. Right. Yeah, we were trying to figure out what's the smallest, lightest one we could do. And with that design, it would have a payload capability of 100 kilograms. So it could soft land payloads onto the lunar surface weighing 100 kilograms. And similarly, it could retrieve packets from the lunar surface, each weighing 100 kilograms. It would take a couple of weeks to reel it up, from the lunar surface up to the L1 point.
It's not going to be carrying crew or anything. Initially, this is just going to be
probably not on the first ones. It would make it a lot easier for crew, because one of the things we can do is we can carry fuel propellants back and forth. We could deliver fuel to the lunar surface very cheaply. So a human rocket, a lunar module could land on the lunar surface and it could refuel using fuel that was delivered there from the lunar elevator, for example. And that would save a lot of weight and save a lot of cost. One of the things, by the way, there's a couple of guys at NASA we have spoken to who understand it, but we haven't been able to get the agencies to adopt it as a whole. It would be a great benefit to NASA. For example, a few years ago, NASA basically had given up almost completely on any more manned lunar landings for the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is the cost. They designed a system they called Constellation using chemical rockets, planning to use this. Originally they called it the Ares rocket. Now that's kind of morphed into the Space Launch System. But using the Ares rocket, they figured out that it would just be way too expensive using chemical rockets to soft land people back to the moon. They were basically sort of copying what they did on Apollo. And in real terms, NASA's budget today is much less than it was in the Apollo days. They calculated that the Constellation program over a 10-year period would cost $100 billion.
Wow.
Which was way, way more expensive than they could handle.
Yeah.
With a lunar elevator, we can reduce the cost of the constellation operations to probably about 15 billion by a factor of six. If we, that's not counting the capital cost of the lunar elevator, of course. And the capital cost could be as low as $800 million. You probably want to make a bigger one because a 100-kilogram payload is not that much. And you just have to make it bigger, and it costs a bit more to get bigger payload.
Well, Charles, so, wouldn't you think it would be better to privatize the whole thing?
It could be done. Certainly, it could be done privately, and that's possibly where the helium-3 comes in.
Because you're never gonna get Congress, funding for NASA doing this.
With the current climate, that's probably true. They've gotten their priorities. They're not looking at the moon anymore. They're looking at asteroids and maybe Mars. So they've kind of lost sight of the moon.
That's
unfortunate.
Yeah, it's very unfortunate. I mean, look at the 50s and 60s and 70s of how, NASA, the American people, the sense of wonder with space and the moon and all that stuff. People would have been behind this. Now they're like, they think going to space is a waste of time. They think about, American people would just be like, I don't want our tax money going to that, yada, yada.
I think it can be done commercially. One of the benefits of one of the reasons why, so why would we want to build a lunar elevator? What's the value of it? Because there are actually a lot of valuable resources and a lot of valuable minerals on the moon, which are commercially very valuable. And because of the very heavy Earth gravity well, there are two reasons why the having minerals on the moon is strategically very valuable. And that is if you want to build large structures in space, it's much cheaper in terms of energy to get them from the moon with a lunar elevator than it is to launch them from Earth with chemical rockets. And I calculated it's more or less a factor of six to launch. If you want to get something into low Earth orbit, it takes you six times more energy to launch it from Earth than it does to launch it from the moon. And to put it another way,
I think that you would expect them to be very interested in this, because surely it would be more cost effective to actually launch a mission to Mars from the moon.
Yeah. I mean, we can actually manufacture fuel on the moon, because one of the biggest costs of sending a mission to Mars is the weight of the mass of the propellant and the fuel, at least if you're using chemical rockets, which is probably what we will be. And if we can get fuel propellant, that's fuel and oxidizer from the moon, which we can, and then deliver that to Earth orbit and have refueling propellant depots in Earth orbit, that would make a mission to Mars about eight times cheaper than taking the propellant up from Earth.
We would want to use resources that are on Mars too, like water
but we can get water from the moon. We can get, in fact, 80% of your propellant weight is actually oxidizer or oxygen. And oxygen is very, very readily available from the moon. All you have to do, actually, you can get some oxygen just by melting the moon rock. If you get some basic moon rock, put it in a solar furnace and melt it. Which is not that difficult to do. It's done on Earth all the time. You actually get some oxygen just bubbles right out of the molten rock Wow. Now you can increase the yield dramatically by using leaching agents such as hydrogen fluoride, and so there are processes where we can get quite a lot of oxygen out of moon rock, and then that can be liquefied as liquid oxygen and transported to Earth orbit and used as rocket propellant. So that's 80% of your rocket propellant right there, 80% by weight, and it's the weight which matters. And then hydrogen, there are a couple of ways you can get that. Well, fuel essentially would be some form of hydrogen or hydrocarbon, and there are a couple of ways of getting that on the moon. A lot of people talk about the water ice, which we know exists now at the lunar poles. Mm-hmm. And you can use solar power to crack the water ice into hydrogen and oxygen by electrolysis. And then another thing we can do is actually if you just heat the lunar dust, the topsoil on the moon, the top 10 feet or 3 meters or so, is pulverized rock. It's dust. Formed by billions of years of meteorite impacts, so it's finer than beach sand. Mm. And this regolith, you just scoop it up with a shovel and heat it to about 800 degrees C, and when you heat it to that temperature, it starts to emit an interesting cocktail of gases, which includes quite a lot of hydrogen as well as helium, and even some water, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide. So you do have to heat quite a lot of a lot of dust to get a reasonable quantity of these gases off. But it's doable.
Plus it gets into everything.
The dust does. Yeah.
And they. I've seen.
University.
I've seen. Where they have little habitats on the moon and stuff like that, to where they're trying to one of the big problems is that any astronauts going in or out of those habitats, they still haven't figured out a way to keep the dust from, you know, when the person comes in, from getting into everything, getting in the seals of the doors, you know, all sorts of things. So,
well, it's one of the major bugbears in the suits, isn't it, when the creation of the suits and the movement.
Yeah.
And I watched a program recently about the problems with the suits for long-haul space travel, say, for example, to Mars.
There are a couple of ways around it that would mitigate it somewhat. But one way is to have a suit which... Where you enter it through the back, where it's a sort of a back, you have the back, the swing sliding door, and you back up to the airlock, so that the legs and arms and head are still dangling outside,
right?
But you hook it up at the back to a seal, and then you open the door at the back of the suit and kind of drop out of there into the airlock, which is pressurized by then. So most of the dust stays outside, although you'll still get some dust from the door. But they'll need to have a shower or something to wash it all off when you come in. Otherwise, you'll be dropping dust all over the place. Plus, it's quite hazardous as well. It's damaging to the lungs if you breathe it.
Well, it's like talcum powder or any of those very fine powders. They're all dangerous to breathe in for their own reasons,
So you'd want to wash it off. And it's also, by the way, it's also explosive.
If
you get enough
Great.
Of it, they discovered it's because of it's got what's called nanophase iron in it, which are very, very microscopic particles of iron.
And with the powder as well, that's a tinderbox waiting to happen. I've actually worked in pyrotechnics, so I understand, the nature of the materials, especially very fine powders. Even curry
powder.
Well,
say Charles.
Charles. All the... mostly robotic. Yeah.
Right. So see, Charles, all of this gets put into place. And it's put into place to mine helium-3. Who has control over helium-3? Because it's going to be if it's something, if it's an energy source or something like that, somebody's going to control it. Somebody's going to want to give it away. They're going to bill it.
Yeah. So let me describe the nature of helium-3 and why it's interesting. And this is actually maybe a little different from what you might have heard from other folks. Helium-3 is an isotope of regular helium. So there are two stable forms of helium that are known to exist, helium-3 and helium-4. And the vast majority of helium in the universe is helium-4. Helium-3 on Earth is very rare. In fact, it's practically non-existent and in nature on Earth, although it's abundant on the Moon. But on Earth, helium-3 was really became available during the Cold War because it's a byproduct of the decay of tritium. And when the Soviet Union and the Western USA and other countries were building lots of thermonuclear warheads, they off-gassed. They had lots of tritium in them, and the tritium off-gassed the helium-3, and they collected this helium-3. And they started to find that it's actually a very interesting substance, and it does a lot of very cool and interesting things. One of them is that theoretically it's a very good fuel for nuclear fusion, and there's been a lot of talk of mining helium-3 from the Moon for nuclear fusion, and one day that might be possible, but unfortunately today nobody has built a nuclear fusion reactor that makes a profit of energy. I mean, there are some fusion reactors, and in fact, you can buy them. You can buy them yourself and build them in your garage as a kit, but they consume more energy than they produce. There are companies that you can buy them from. They're called fuses. But it turns out that helium-3 actually has commercial applications today. There are essentially three classes of users for helium-3 currently in commercial uses. I mean, it's widely used by research scientists for experimental purposes. It's liquid helium-3 is colder than regular liquid helium, right? So you can get to some incredibly low cryogenic temperatures using helium-3. Some electronic companies are experimenting with it for super cool semiconductors. But one of the most successful applications of it has been in neutron detectors, essentially Geiger counters. But helium-3 is absolutely the best gas to use for neutron detectors. It's better than nothing else comes close. There's another isotope called boron-10 that can be used, but it's really helium. Its performance is nothing like helium-3. And what was found after the 9/11 attack, September 11th, in the USA, the Department of Homeland Security was created, and part of their charter is to screen all cargo shipments for nuclear fissile material. They're worried about dirty bombs and terrorists smuggling nuclear material.
Right. Yeah.
And they realized pretty quickly that the only way to really screen the cargo out is to use neutron detectors. Because all fissile material gives off neutrons.
Yeah.
And it's impossible to hide that. Well, at least if you have good neutron detectors.
That's interesting.
So, and the Department of Home Security started buying up large quantities of helium-3, or at least they started buying lots of neutron detectors, and the neutron detectors needed helium-3. And their program was quite aggressive. It was to equip every airport, every seaport, and every border crossing in the United States with neutron detectors so that every shipment, every single container, every shipment of material going in or out of the United States is screened. Well, I don't know how much they've actually got deployed yet, but the idea is that all of it will be screened. There are other uses for helium-3 also. The natural gas exploration industry uses it for well logging. And I don't know the details, but again, that's some kind of a neutron method that they use. I'm not an expert in well logging, so I don't know what it is, what exactly it is that they do with it. But I do know that there is now a shortage of helium-3, and there is a White House task force that's been established because it's in such short supply, and one of the priority users is the natural gas exploration industry. At the White House level, they have been given priority. The third class of users for helium-3 is Medicol. MRI machines use helium-3.
Okay.
And there's a robust demand for that. So the White House is prioritizing the medical users and the natural gas exploration industry. And this, by the way, became significant because, so the history of it was in the Cold War, we got all these warheads and they started venting off helium-3. And for a while, there was a stockpile of helium-3, and it was just getting more, and it was just getting collected, and the stockpile was getting bigger and bigger as more of the stuff was gassing off. But then demand started to increase. As people started to find these commercial uses, they started buying this helium-3 from the U.S. government, and the U.S. government was selling it at auction. And demand started to outstrip supply. And it became very acute in the year 2008, 2 years. That's like 5 years ago. There was a bit of a crisis because what happened is the supply of helium-3 has been dwindling. I mean, demand has exceeded supply for about 15 years now. And they suddenly realized in 2008 that the stockpile was going down. And they introduced rationing. And there was prior to 2008, the annual demand was 80,000 liters a year, and now they're only allowing 14,000 liters a year at auction.
Wow!
So the price jumped almost overnight. In 2006, 2007, the price had been going about $100 to $200 a liter. And it increased by about over a factor of 10. And at the end of 2008, the price was selling at auction for over $2,000 a liter.
Wow.
Today, the rumor is it's going on the secondary market for about $4,000 a liter. That's about $1 million per ounce.
God.
So it's one of the most valuable and one of the most sought-over materials in the world.
Yeah.
And it's still running out, even though it's being rationed in the United States. And the United States is the biggest supplier of helium-3. You can get it from Russia. Russia also has a stockpile of helium-3. But there's less, I guess there's less transparency over there, and we don't really know how much they have left.
Yeah,
but the current projection is that in the United States, sometime between 2025 and 2035, it will all be gone. There'll be no helium-3 left, possibly on Earth.
Okay.
We can get it from the moon. The prices are high enough now that. According to my back-of-the-envelope calculations, we could make a profit at it, even without nuclear fusion. We don't need nuclear fusion reactors to start a business for helium-3. We can start it today with the existing market.
You think somebody will be jumping all over this then?
Well, you think, and I keep trying to get the word out, and some people are starting to get it. You know, there's a, I've had a good discussion with one of my acquaintances over at NASA Kennedy Space Center, Dr. Phil Metzger, and he gets it.
Yeah.
And then there's one or two other people. I don't mind mentioning Phil Metzger because he's a sort of a public figure.
Yeah.
And he's very happy to talk to the public about his research. That he has a group there that's looking at lunar resource exploration.
So this is a really important thing, there, isn't it?
Yes.
Because we've all come to rely on these, like, you know, commonplace things such as the MRIs, and you know, we will be struggling without that kind of technology.
Yes. It's going to get worse.
And
like I say, there are some substitutes, but they're not very good. The Department of Homeland Security has stopped using helium-3 because the White Book, out of the rationing, they are going with the boron-10 neutron detectors, which are adequate. I actually had a conversation once with somebody at the Homeland Security, and they told me that the boron-10 detectors are adequate for what they're trying to do.
Mm.
Obviously, they would prefer to get the helium-3, but the White House has determined that the priority now goes to the medical and the natural gas people.
So are there any serious contenders for this project, for actually mining the helium-3? Or is this the only idea that's on the table?
There are other businesses that you can do on the moon. That there are other valuable minerals, and I'd be happy to go over some of those.
Okay.
Another very interesting resource on the moon is there's a family of elements called rare earth elements, or REEs, R-E-E, rare earth elements, and I don't have them all in memory, but they're sort of in the middle of the periodic table of elements, and there's things like gallium, germanium, lanthanum, selenium, and a whole bunch. The tellurium is another one. Okay, so, and I think there's about 40 of these rare earth elements, which are kind of obscure. And they're expensive, and they're relatively rare. And they are in increasing demand by our technology industries, the semiconductor industries, renewable energy. They're needed for making things like magnets, lots of electronic components. Chips have various of these rare earth elements in them. I mean, your mobile phones, your laptops, your tablets, all of those have components containing rare earth elements.
Yeah, yeah.
And also they're in batteries. They're used in batteries for electrolytes. They're used for certain types of lubricants, actually in electric motors. And they're used in alloys for a lot of electrical applications. And the demand in the last couple of decades, the demand for these elements has really skyrocketed.
Yeah.
And the prices skyrocketed. And the interesting thing is 96% of the world's rare earth elements resources are located in one country. You want to guess which country that
China?
Is?
China?
The People's Republic of China. They possess 96% of the world's rare earth elements.
Oh, wow. What a setup.
And they are manipulating the market, or they're trying to. There was a lawsuit at the World Trade Organization a couple of years ago which ruled against China, and for a while China had stopped exporting some of the rare earth elements, and they were insisting that they would only be used for local Chinese companies. So that would shut down a lot of the Western electronics companies.
Yeah.
They were just literally trying to kill the competition, and the World Trade Organization.
They're absolutely hell bent.
The World Trade Organization ruled against them, so they are. China has resumed exporting rare earth elements,
right.
But it's a terrific, it's a very powerful foreign policy weapon that they have, a tool in their arsenal. I mean, if China wanted to. If there was ever any kind of a military confrontation with China, you can bet that they would shut off the supply of rare earth elements and we'd be in big trouble.
Mm.
And the only place that I know to get rare earth elements is, other than China, is on the moon.
Wow.
There is a... One of the interesting discoveries of the Apollo program... when they got the samples back to Earth from some sites, they discovered an interesting mineral, which as far as I know, it does not exist on Earth. It's called creep, K-R-E-E-P, where the K stands for phosphorus, the R-E-E stands for rare earth elements. Sorry, the K stands for potassium, the R-E-E stands for rare earth elements, and the P stands for phosphorus. So it's called creep.
Right.
And there's four or five sites on the moon where this creep substance is quite concentrated, and it's formed by an unusual process. It's a very old material. It was formed via the lunar maria. The seas were formed by huge magma oceans. And when these magma oceans were cooling down, this creep material floated to the top and accumulated in certain locations in high concentrations. And we know where they are. We've got, from all the lunar orbiter data, we've got very good data on where these creep deposits are on the moon. So we know right where to go to get it.
Yeah.
So that's another business model. And interestingly enough, one site of creep is very accessible for the lunar elevator. The lunar elevator would be tethered to the moon's equator, which makes it somewhat challenging to access materials at the lunar poles. But there is a very large deposit of creep mineral on the lunar equator, very close to where we would anchor the lunar elevator. So that's one market. With the lunar elevator, we can start collecting helium-3, and we can start collecting creep minerals. The creep, we'd probably have to try and process it on the moon to try and refine it and concentrate it before shipping it back to Earth. So we probably want to drop some processing equipment onto the moon first.
Mm.
Let's see, what else? Helium-3, creep. Oh yes, the third substance which is interesting on the moon is platinum, or platinum group metals, which includes platinum. Platinum group metals include iridium and rhodium, and a couple of other very, very valuable noble metals like that. There's also some gold, by the way. The platinum group metals actually fetch a higher price per ounce than gold. But where does the platinum come from on the moon? Well, it comes from pulverized meteorites.
All right.
And you probably heard a lot of talk about mining asteroids for platinum and so forth. Well, ladies and gentlemen, anything you can get from an asteroid, you can get from the moon, because the top 10 feet of the moon is 10% asteroid material.
Of course, yeah.
For billions of years, the moon has been pelted by meteorites, and there are four or five different categories of meteorites. There's stony, there's carbonaceous, there's chondrites, and there's metal. There's pure metal ones. There's what they call stony iron, and then there's nickel iron. And the nickel iron meteorites, well, the stony irons and some of the chondrites contain quite a lot of nickel iron alloy in them. And the nickel iron alloy has platinum dissolved in it, or several platinum group metals. It's quite feasible to have a little refinery on the moon where we extract the platinum. You know, we can use magnets to extract the magnetic nickel iron particles, and then melt them. You don't necessarily have to melt them. You can dissolve them in acids or melt them and get and separate the platinum and then bring the platinum back.
You know, I watched a special on these gold mines, to where they go in and they have, it just looks like a big strip mining operation where they, these bulldozers go in and they fill up these dump trucks, these huge dump trucks with just dirt. And the gold is, in the dirt is just, you know, microscopic. And they process this down, and it was unbelievable. They got like, out of each truckload, they get like, I don't know, something like 20 gold bars. It's something, it's some ridiculous amount of money. It's like $20 million worth of gold out of dirt, you know?
Wow.
And I think if, you know, you get these types of companies involved because they're the ones that are going to do the tech around it. They're the ones that's going to have the mining up. They're going to have the equipment and they're going to have the know-how to, the cheapest way to, you know, just scoop it up, process it. You can process it right there on the moon. You know what I mean? You don't have to send all the moon stuff back. You just process it there and then, you know, this huge massive amount of dirt. And then you've got this, you know, amount of really small, well, not really small, but manageable amount of product to, you know, use. And you could just shoot that down the elevator or, you know, or whatever, or store it there.
All right, exactly. Yeah, I think that's basically the valid approach. And all these businesses become enabled by a lunar elevator, because if we use chemical rockets, we'll never get there. It's just not affordable.
It's not feasible, is it? No.
No. But the thing about the lunar elevator is and that's one point I should emphasize, when you launch a rocket from Earth into space, all right, the amount of payload you can carry depends on what orbit you're going into. It varies quite a lot. I mean, if you go into low Earth orbit, let me hope I remember the numbers correctly, but to get from, if you inject into geosynchronous orbit, you have a penalty of a factor of 8. That is, that you can put 8 times as much payload into low Earth orbit as you can into geosynchronous orbit for any given rocket. So that means the cost goes up accordingly. So there are two numbers that are interesting. To get a payload from the surface of the Earth to the lunar L1 Lagrange location where the elevator would be anchored, if you compare sending payloads to the L1 point versus launching from Earth and soft landing onto the surface of the moon, it's the penalty there is a factor of 6. So you can put 6 times as much material at the L1 location as you can on the surface of the moon. And then transporting from L1 to the surface of the moon is basically free if you have the lunar elevator. So that's why the Constellation program would be 6 times cheaper if you had a lunar elevator than using chemical rockets. And that's why, you know, putting mining equipment on the moon would be 6 times cheaper with a lunar elevator.
That's excellent.
And so that makes it much more attractive. and then transporting material from the moon. So that's just going in one direction. From the Earth to the moon becomes six times cheaper. Going from the moon to the Earth, that's basically free. That becomes, you know, thousands of times cheaper because all you have to do is you take your payload from the moon and it runs up the elevator via the electric car, and then it goes past the L1 point and it just keeps on going because the cable extends another 150,000 miles towards the Earth. So you run down the end of that cable to the counterweight, and by the time you're there, you're actually fairly deep into the Earth's gravity field, and you're starting to get a pretty strong pull, and yet the velocity is quite low compared to being in orbit. So all you have to do is release the payload, let go of it, and it will drop straight down towards the Earth, and it, with a very, very small rocket thrust, you just have to kill a little bit of velocity, and then it'll drop straight into the Earth's atmosphere. So the cost of traveling from the moon to the Earth is almost free.
Yes, negligible, isn't it? Yeah. Well, we're at the top of the hour now, Charles. So we're going to cut to a break.
Good.
We'll have 10 minutes, so you can run off and get a cup of tea or whatever.
And
we'll see you back in 10 minutes, and we shall continue the talk. Thank you.
Sounds good. Shall I stay on the line?
Yes, please.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. I'll stay on the line, and I'll mute and listen.
Okay. Is he still with us? Well, we'll just have a bit of dead air while Joe talks. Hi, welcome back to the second part of Citizen Sane. Our guest tonight is Charles Radley, who is science moon genius, and my co-host is Guy Weddell. We've been talking about the lunar elevator and the benefits of mining helium-3 and other minerals from the moon. Hi, Charles, are you with us?
Hello, yes.
Hello, welcome
here.
Back.
Good to be back.
Right. Okay, so we were moving on to why is it so important? What do we need it for?
Yes. So I talked about some of the main issues. So, yeah, we're from the moon. The moon is a very valuable source of rocket fuel, rocket propellant, and also helium-3, which is commercially has a very good market price. And we can also get platinum or platinum group metals, and we can also get rare earth elements. All of these are commodities which fetch very good prices on the world market.
You know, but this whole conversation about, you know, all these different elements and everything on the moon is reminding me of Dune, whoever controls the spice.
Oh, right, yeah.
You know, kind of controls everything, you know, so.
Yeah, spice. Yes.
I think whoever gets there and gets the whole process and everything going, it's going to be like the internet and everything, how it created a whole new economy. I think in the future when this happens, it's going to create an entirely new economy for the world. And
yes, I think so, and that's the idea. I think, and that's how we're going to expand humanity into the solar system and out into the cosmos. I mean, you know, the taxpayers, I can't pay for it anymore. But I think we can do it commercially. And
given the choice, Charles, I think we'd rather be funding space research rather than war, to be honest. But we're not given that choice.
I agree. Yeah.
So what's the future then?
I'm trying to spread the word about the lunar elevator, and there are some people, you know, that get it. One area that we'd like to do, I participate in Liftport Group. I'm also involved with a non-profit tax-exempt organization called Leeward Space Foundation. Your donations are tax-deductible if you're a U.S. taxpayer. And we are trying to pursue projects to realize eventually a lunar elevator. And one of these would be to fly tethered satellites and to push the state of the art. There've been a couple of fairly successful tethered satellites that have flown. The longest one is actually a European one. About 10 years ago, the European Space Agency flew a satellite called YES-2, YES-2. That stood for Young Engineers and Scientists or something like that, because they had a lot of student volunteers helping, which saved them a lot of money. And they launched this payload on a Russian resource capsule and deployed it. And they deployed it to a length of nearly 31 kilometers. So that's the record for the longest string that's been deployed in space so far, 31 kilometers. And I've spoken to the group at ESTEC in the Netherlands that put that experiment together, and there's some leftover hardware that we could use, and we could build another experiment fairly cheaply. We figured we could break the record. We could go to 100 kilometers fairly easily, and then we'd like to go to 1,000, and then just keep making it longer and longer. And you can make it longer. I forget the lengths. They come in lengths of a couple of kilometers. This Xylon thread. It comes off a spool of a couple of kilometers, but it's pretty easy to splice them together. So you can splice it to thousands or thousands of kilometers in length. One of the challenges of a lunar elevator, by the way, is micrometeoroid damage. When you have a tether that's so long, right, tens of thousands of kilometers long, every few months it will get severed by a little micrometeorite. A little speck of dust flying along will impact it and cut the cable. Unfortunately, we've analyzed it. Special Marshall Eubanks has done quite a lot of analysis on the density of micrometeorites. And that's the way it is. So we're constantly going to have to be repairing it. And what we could do is we could make use of a concept. There's a company in Washington State, another company in Washington State called Tethers Unlimited, which has done quite a lot of work on space tethers, at least a lot of design and analysis. And they were co-founded by two smart gentlemen, Dr. Robert Forwood, who passed away some years ago, and Dr. Bob Hoyt. Bob Hoyt has designed a multi-stranded tether called the Hoyt tether. So the idea is you don't just have your tether isn't just a single strand. You maybe have a dozen or 20 strands, and they're separated by little spaces, right? Every few hundred meters or so. So what happens is when a micrometeorite comes along, it will sever one of the strands. The probability that it would sever more than one strand is practically zero. But once a month or once every couple of months, we will get one of those strands severed. So we will have to have a repair robot. And every now and then, this repair robot is going to have to run down and resplice the broken strands. And operations of the elevator will be temporarily suspended while the little robot goes down and fixes it.
The logistics of this whole thing is just mind-boggling.
Yeah.
All the stuff that you're going to have to account for. I mean, I come from an IT background, project management and that sort of thing, and it was my job to look and find all those little things and have some way to fix it, like a disaster plan or something like that. I mean, you're talking about something back and forth on the moon. You have stuff mining and then getting it back to Earth. And it just you know, freaking blows my mind. I mean,
well,
really.
It is pretty complicated, but, you know, there are a lot of industries on Earth that are pretty complicated and that are very profitable.
Right.
And even the oil industry these days and you know, the techniques they have, they're using fracking now, which is quite a complicated technique. And there are drilling rigs that are drilling thousands of feet down on the ocean floor. I find that mind-boggling.
I can't stand that. I think that's disgraceful what they're doing.
That segues into another topic. Another area that would be facilitated by lunar mining is space solar power. We could put what are known as solar power satellites into Earth orbit, and we could build them from lunar materials, and we could collect solar energy, and we could beam it down at the surface of the down to the surface of the Earth using microwaves, which are actually pretty harmless. We could get rid of fossil fuels completely and replace them with solar power satellites. That's the vision that I have. That was a vision that was first written. The book that I highly recommend is a bit dated now, but it's still fairly valid. And that's called The High Frontier Colonies in Space by Dr. Gerard O'Neill. Gerard O'Neill passed away about 10 or 12 years ago. I did get to meet him three times in the 1980s. And he was an amazing visionary, and he wrote this wonderful book that described how you could use the resources of the moon to build solar power satellites. And, if you want to get me started on renewable energy and...
Please, it's it is a topic near and dear to our hearts, because we are absolutely dismayed at the wanton destruction of this planet for energy, when we know that it's so readily available all around us. And can easily be harnessed or generated, and it never is.
I think there are many, many resources in space. I mean, once in a while I run into people saying, well, we shouldn't trash the moon. And I actually kind of say, well, I would rather trash the moon than trash the Earth. because there's nothing, the moon, there's nothing there. It's just rocks and dust. There's no animals, there's no people, there's no biospheres.
There's nothing going to go extinct.
Anything. And I the way I look at it is, I would like to get remove as much industry and as much mining and drilling and stop all that on the Earth and do all that on the moon instead. And then we can save the planet and
ourselves, more importantly.
It's healthy. We can get rid of all the air pollution, and the wildlife can recover, and we'd all be healthy and better off.
Yeah, and once and for all, we can get all the Nazis off the moon. You know.
Oh, there was a movie about that. I haven't seen that movie yet. I need to see that.
Oh, it's great. It's great satire. It starts out kind of shaky, but, you know, once you get into it, start watching it, it's pretty damn funny.
What's that called? Iron Sky or something?
Yeah, Iron Sky, yeah.
Yeah,
it's good.
It's on my watch list. I think the moon is an exciting and interesting place. I think the asteroids are actually a distraction. I think we will go to the asteroids one day, but something people don't understand about the asteroids, it takes a round trip mission to an asteroid takes years, usually many years. And a round trip mission to the moon takes about a week. And we can get industries and businesses started much, much more quickly on the moon than we can on the asteroids. I mean, the irony is, because of the way orbital mechanics works, the closer the asteroid is, the longer it takes to get there, believe it or not. it's just the way, because of the phasing of the orbit works. I mean, the proponents say, it takes very little energy to get to the near-Earth asteroids. And it is true that it's less energy than soft landing on the moon, at least using chemical rockets. But with a lunar elevator, that advantage goes away. I mean, with a lunar elevator, the moon is much closer than the Earth asteroids. And if people understood that, I think we'd hear less talk of the asteroids and more talk of the moon. So the companies that want to go mine the asteroids, you know, I'm actually an advisor to one, so I should be careful with the soft space company.
You mean was?
And they have my full support, and I do what I can to help out. But I think the moon, it would make more sense to start with the moon, especially.
It's great to have different options, and it's great to be looking at different types of projects, you know, to offset what's going out there, because there's, I think the thing holding us back is a lot of people are afraid to take the first step, corporation-wise, to take that. You have everything on paper and you have, all the different theories and stuff like that, but it's that first step to make that prototype and to actually start construction and testing and that sort of thing. And that's once you get that rolling, then it starts to come off the actual paper and starts to become clear. And I think once that happens, then you you'll be able to go down that road. It's just right. Convincing people to give you the money. It's all about the money. Yeah. That's all it is, really, if you think about it. It's just the money.
I mean, last year I thought one group that's the most active, to my knowledge, in promoting lunar elevator currently is Liftport Group, which I mentioned earlier. But we're not getting much traction, unfortunately. We did put in a proposal to the NASA Institute of Advanced Concepts about a year ago, but it was not selected. There were a lot of other competing proposals that were selected. So I am very pleased to have this opportunity to try and get the word out a little bit. My name's Charles Radley. If anybody wants to contact me, I'm on Facebook, I'm on LinkedIn, I'm on Google+. I'm not hard to find.
you're gonna have to go private. I mean, you're gonna have to go with Virgin. Yeah, I mean, that's where you're going to have to go. I mean, yeah. like a John Hurt character in Contact. I mean, Charles, that's where you're going to have to go, because these people really aren't bogged down by the management and the whole red tape and the whole process of NASA and the government and all that. These people will have no problems. Getting their name attached to this. You know what I mean? It's their legacy. Yeah. And I think those are the people you're going to have to, if I was you, you're going to have to start whining and dining them, because these guys aren't stupid, They can look at this a long term. And they have tons of resources that work for them that can come up with stuff, Maybe these guys actually own the material that you need to make this stuff,
If we don't hurry up, China are going to get up there before us, and you can bet your bottom dollar that they'll be doing all of that before, you can say Jack Flash. They are dying to get up on the moon. I didn't understand what the panic was. There seemed to be this kind of furor that built up over recent years of who was going to get to the moon, and now there's this kind of like little space race going on because everybody wants to get up there, and now it's obvious as to why. But, that is a real possibility that somebody else is going to get there first.
China has a very active moon program, probably more active than anybody currently. They've had two orbiters in orbit. They had one in orbit around the moon right now, Chang'e 2. Chang'e 1, they shut that down a few years ago. And they actually have on the launch pad right now, they've got the Chang'e 3, which will have a little rover that they're going to soft land on the moon sometime in the next month or two, I believe. Mm-hmm. So that'll be, I wonder how much, if that'll give a publicity splash, because that'll be the first soft landing on the moon since 1976.
Wow.
And it will be Chinese, mm-hmm. Chang'e 3. You know, assuming it works, unless they have an accident or something. But so far, the Chinese moon probes have been very successful. So I hope we can keep up with them.
You know, maybe talk to the other governments. I mean. The European Space Agency was instrumental in getting the probe on Titan, you know?
Yes, yeah, the Huygens probe.
Yeah, that is just unbelievable to me. And, you know, nobody gave a crap. American public?
Yeah, yeah.
They didn't give a crap about it, you know? If you look about how...
I saw the pictures, and it was quite remarkable. It worked
really
well.
Think about how they landed the Curiosity rover on Mars. If you guys haven't looked at this, it is absolutely mind-boggling. Because the last rovers were
complicated.
My God,
it
was
a crane and it
I was just
it
like
was the sky crane and they dropped it from the sky crane and it soft landed and
yeah,
and
it was all
done by. It wasn't even remote control because the time lag was too long. It was a little onboard computer that did the whole thing without any help from Earth.
Yep. And my philosophy is, if you want to do something, you can do it. I mean, you just have to do it. I mean, when they introduced the process that they were going to use for Curiosity, the people on NASA, like the managers that they were pitching this to, I mean, their mouths were wide open. They were like, you can't be freaking serious, you know. And they're like, nope, you know, we can do this. You know, we're landing a one-ton vehicle on a different planet. You know, we have to be inventive and come up with this these new types of ways to do this. You know, it's the only way it's going to happen. And
we could put an elevator on Mars, by the way, as well. On Mars, we'd have to anchor it to the moon phobos.
Well, I was going to ask that, actually, because you could actually just planet hop with it, couldn't you, eventually? If you've been on the moon long enough, you know, everything's set up there, you can actually go from the moon to Mars and then do the same, and you know, wherever. And over the time, obviously, the propulsion technology that we're developing is going to be way out there. And it's all really doable, you know, in the quite near future. All of this is really, really doable.
And once you have all your best practices set up and that sort of thing, I mean, you just reapply it to the next,
your next planet.
You know, yeah, and you just adjust for the different things, you know, make little adjustments here and there. I mean, because, this is what's important about going into space. And this is what, the problems I had with the Challenger program is because we stopped exploring. We were just, you know, it was just something, it was just like a transport system. There wasn't any, I can't really say there wasn't any knowledge gained or anything like that, but it just seemed it was a whole waste of money that we weren't, that we stopped. We just stopped going for the stars, you know? And we just kind of were stuck in a rut. And, you know, Obama comes along and says, enough already.
I think we need to emphasize the value and the commercial potential of industries in space and the moon. I mean, I was disappointed in that election campaign a few years ago when Newt Gingrich was... part of his platform, he was talking about building a moon base, and the media, you know, trashed him. The media said the guy, you know, he's a nutcase, and he was trying to advertise, you know, just building a moon base just for the sake of it, for the prestige, using tax dollars. And I actually, you know, I think we all agree that that's not going to work. We just don't have the money to do that. And I was disappointed that Newt Gingrich, if he had understood the commercial potential, I mean, they need to spin it in terms of, you know, we're not just going to build a moon base, we're going to build a mining operation, we're going to get helium-3, we're going to get platinum, and we're going to get rare earth elements, and we're going to make a lot of money.
And then we won't need China.
And that should have been, right. And that should have been the sales pitch. And it was a big missed opportunity. I was disappointed that opportunity was missed.
Because I don't think he was knowledgeable of the situation. You know what I mean? I think it was just this, he was being counseled by people saying, yeah, let's go get us back on the moon, you know, and that sort of thing. And it could be kind of glamorous.
The old,
you know,
Kennedy days.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that, you know, that we don't have the money for that. I mean, the right now, as we speak, we can't figure out how to pay the existing federal government. And, you know, we've got sequestration, the spending's been frozen. And
that's just all mismanagement. That's mismanagement, all it is. I've worked for the government, and it's absolutely, I was just absolutely blown away by how, you know, nobody talks to each other. They're all compartmentalized. It's just a nightmare dealing with, you know, one department dealing with another one. I mean, it is. It's crazy. Right. And
why something like the Apollo program was able to cut across all of that, because it was an inspiring program and everybody was excited and motivated.
Right.
But, you know, we need something like that. Otherwise, everything's just going to turn into a big bureaucracy.
And people even got tired of that. They're like, look, we're just funding rocks up there, and people are all like yawning, you know.
Well, the public. The public got a little jaded. And the bottom line, Apollo had achieved its objective, which was to beat the Soviet Union. And in the end, we beat the pants off the Soviet Union, and after that, they felt it was, you know, flogging a dead horse or whatever.
Right.
But like I said, I was really inspired by Gerard O'Neill's book. I mean, I am a child of Apollo. I watched, you know, all the Apollo missions on live TV, or most of them.
I remember being a little kid and seeing that stuff.
And then when it all finished, you know, the last Apollo was in 1972. And then after that, nothing much seemed to happen until I read, you know, Gerard O'Neill's book was published in 1976. And let me talk a little bit more about the Lagrange vibrations points, because that was a key point of Gerard O'Neill's book. I talked about the point between the Earth and the Moon is Lagrange point number one. There are actually five Lagrange locations. There's another one, and each of these Lagrange locations are gravitationally balanced, where the forces of the Earth and the Moon are balanced out. So if you put an object there, it will tend to stay there. And so this L2 is slightly beyond the Moon. And then L3 is opposite the Moon, behind the Earth. Difficult to convey this in words. If I had a blackboard or a computer screen, I could show you. And there's some nice diagrams in the book that explain it all. But L4 and L5 are what are called Trojan points. They are, if you look at the Moon's orbit, there's a circle around the Earth. L4 is 60 degrees ahead of the Moon, and L5 is 60 degrees behind the Moon on the Moon's orbit. And O'Neill calculated that the L4 and L5 locations were ideal locations for putting space factories. And at the time he wrote his book, nobody had thought of the lunar elevator. So he was proposed to use electromagnetic mass drivers to catapult material from the Moon to these L4, L5 locations. But actually, the lunar elevator was much cheaper than the catapults, and we would use the L1 point instead. But what happened in the shortly after the O'Neill's book came out, a lot of people read the book and got very excited by it. And they actually formed an organization called the L5 Society, which was named after the L5 point in the moon's orbit. And the L5 Society eventually morphed. What happened was about the same time, Wernher von Braun started another organization called the National Space Institute, which was loosely modeled on the National Geographical Society. And in 1983, the Alpha Psi Society merged with the National Space Institute and formed what is now called the National Space Society. And I'm a member of that. And I was I did serve a 2-year term on the board of directors of that organization. But that's one of the largest space advocacy groups where a bunch of us were trying to get things, you know, going again after the end of Apollo. And we have not yet gotten the traction. We're still trying. There are a couple other space advocacy groups out there. This Planetary Society is quite famous, which was started by Carl Sagan, and they're the biggest. But they don't have much of a commercial mindset. They're promoting mostly the science. And missions to Mars, which are too expensive with chemical rockets. I'm focusing a lot of my efforts, like I said, to the Leeward Space Foundation and Liftport. We are very focused. We're small, lean, we're nimble, and we're very focused on what we're trying to do. The other organizations, they're great. They do good things, but they don't. I don't think they have quite the clarity of vision, that's why I'm putting my vision, my energies into Leeward. And we're small, and we could use all the help we can get.
Yes.
So Leeward is a non-profit, and Liftport is a for-profit. And they're completely separate organizations, but we're friendly and we know each other, we believe in much the same agenda. But for tax reasons, amongst other things, we cannot commingle funds. We have to keep separate because we operate under different legal frameworks, different tax frameworks.
As this becomes viable and travel into space becomes cheap, this is what they want it to be anyway, because I know that they want to militarize space. I've read plenty of documents about the militarization of space and laser beams and death rays and all the rest of it, which is their vision. I know it's nowhere near a reality, but they've put 4 epochs on it. You know, we've got a Vision 2020 to work on. Even George Bush talked about, building these, things in space, but it boils down to control, so I kind of got really into all this space development and all the things that were going on. Then I got sidetracked by the weapons in space issue and teamed up with Carol Roseanne and, went on a bit of a Greenham Common kind of rampage about it. But all of that aside, the whole ethos behind Carol's campaign is actually for space development without the weapons. But, if there was the possibility of putting weapons up there, then the military would be all over it, and they'd be up and down, nobody's business. I could say something rude there, but...
Right. I mean, the good news is according to the 1967 United Nations Treaty, which most of the world has ratified, it is illegal to put weapons of mass destruction into space.
But that would stand if the USA and Russia hadn't pulled out of it about 4 years ago. She's putting together another one because it no longer stands because of the actions of the administration.
The 1967 treaty still stands. Mm. I mean, there was another treaty that's been disbanded. I think, what was that, the Ballistic Missile Defense Treaty.
Right, maybe I've got them confused.
But that's a little, and that's another problem. But the idea of the ballistic missile defense was the weapon systems were going to be based on the Earth and pointing up into space.
Yeah.
And that is allowed. But putting actual Battlestar Galacticas into space is actually illegal under the treaty. Yeah. And that's not likely to change any time soon because it's in the interests of all the parties to keep the status quo.
Carol Roseon seems to think
maybe
that this is an
issue. Down one day, but,
she's, yeah. Well, Carol Roseon's put together another space treaty and she's now trying to generate the funds to go to another 11 nations for them to sign it to overrule what is happening with it now as far as the USA are concerned. She has real concerns about that. And so this is what she's doing right now, and she's campaigning much like yourself. Say, please, you know, just give us some money because we need to go up there. We need to expand, but we don't need to, you know, make it dangerous. We don't need to make it anywhere more dangerous than it already is. Something's shifted there in that, the 67 space treaty, for sure. But, I was under the impression that, the administration had gone to Senate and they'd actually manipulated the laws of the Sea Treaty to change or to find a loophole for weaponizing space. And I think
I'm not very well up on that. But
yeah,
it would be.
They can do it for defense purposes or something. But it's only for defense, not offense. But obviously, you know, they can't behave like that. They don't seem
so. On the commercial side, it's you know, we're trying the trick. I think is to formulate fundable business plans. So if it's too far out, the people like venture capitalists and angel investors, they tend to be somewhat conservative, they tend to invest in, you know,
surefire bets,
things, you know, .coms, you know, mobile phones and things like that. And
ironically, the lack of these elements will affect that.
Yeah, but we're trying to come up with a sort of maybe a stage process, maybe a 10-step process step by step. We can fund one piece of it and get that developed and then fund the next piece and get that developed and over a period of time get everything we need developed privately. So that's kind of the strategy we're following.
Yeah.
But it's a slow uphill process. But maybe, you know, we're just hoping at some point it'll reach critical mass and it'll all take off.
Yeah, I think that's going to probably be the case, actually, because they'll be desperate at some point, and they'll try anything. So and how many geniuses have been called crazy people before?
I'm not right. I'm. It's clear to me, and it's disappointing because there's a lot of people that sort of heap scorn on the lunar elevator idea.
Yeah.
And they won't even listen. They won't negotiate. But there's a few. I mean, I've learned a little bit about marketing, and I've learned the strategy I follow is I don't fight battles with people. I look for allies. And I look for low-hanging fruit, and I look for, you know, people that can be easily converted, as it were, or easily persuaded.
You need to hire like a lobbyist marketing firm.
Exactly.
And to lobby, and because that's how it's done, man. I mean, that's how it's done to get your stuff.
Yeah. But with any radical new idea, what happens is. The target market is characterized in different levels of enthusiasm, I guess. So on the one hand, it's a bell-shaped curve, okay? And on the left-hand side, you've got enthusiasts and early adopters, you know, like geeks and geeks and nerds, and they'll latch onto any new idea because they like new ideas. They think it's cool, and they'll just go for it. So they're very easy to persuade. And then on the far right, you've got the diehard skeptics. They'll never go along with it. Then they'll always just criticize it and throw rocks at it. And then you've got a sort of a continuity spectrum in between. You know, you've got after the enthusiasts, you know, you've got the early adopters, and then you've got the late adopters, and then you've got the mainstream, and then you've got the mild skeptics. And then there's a sort of a chasm. That's what they call the chasm. And it tends to work that if you can get all the enthusiasts on board first, and then you go after the early adopters, and with the early adopters, they'll see what the enthusiasts are doing, so they'll copy it and they'll go along with it. And then there's a bit of a chasm between the early adopters and the late adopters to get to the mainstream, and that's the tricky part, which is kind of we're still up against that. We haven't crossed that chasm yet with the lunar elevator, so we have to keep pushing. We have to keep getting more enthusiasts and more early adopters.
Yeah, there's a credibility gap to be bridged, isn't yeah. there, there? Because it is yeah. such a far-out idea. But, yeah. you know, these far-out ideas are the ones that we need, you know.
Right.
You see it time yeah. over, don't you?
So we'd like to fly, you know, we think for maybe $20 million or something like that, we could fly a 1,000-kilometer tether, for example, and hopefully that would attract a certain amount of attention. And
I should imagine it would.
Yeah.
Do you think...
These are the kind of steps we'd want to take that would get us in the right direction.
Do you think NASA losing that tether in space has put a damper on... what you're trying to do, like getting people to listen and that sort of thing?
Well, it has in the United States. It has, but in a sense, I think they gave up too easy, because the Europeans and ESA has demonstrated that it does work, and they NASA deployed a tether from the space shuttle. They did it twice. And there were some problems with it, but the tether basically worked. But there was some, on the first test flight, there was a mistake made in the design of the mechanism, and a bolt was sticking out and it jammed up. But there was nothing wrong with the tether. They just made a mistake on the mechanism. So they fixed that for the second flight. And then the second flight, the tether got out to about three-quarters of the intended length. But they didn't realize that there was quite a strong electrical potential built up by the tether dragging in the Earth's magnetic plasma field.
Oh, is that...
And it arced, and the tether snapped due to an electric discharge that,
wow.
That melted the tether. That's all, you know... That can be solved. These are just the initial teething problems that you run into on any new project. But NASA basically gave up at that point. But the European Space Agency decided to have another shot at it, and also the U.S. Air Force has had some success with tethers as well. I think that's something we need to work on, getting people to believe that they work.
Mm.
And seeing is believing, I guess. So we want to do some demonstrations. So we're working it on a couple of different fronts. We want to build more on the tether technology, and we want to get people to understand the business plan of the Helium-3 and so forth.
Well, I think, these... companies that have rather invested in mobile phones and tablets, etc., are shooting themselves in their own feet because they actually need these resources, and because they're the ones that are using them up. They're not very forward thinking, are they?
Right, and the governments should be aware of it as well. I mean, the idea of mining the moon for rare earth elements has not been very widely discussed. It's been discussed on a couple of forums, and it's getting a little bit of attention here and there, but it's all on the numbers. We don't really have good enough numbers to make a good business plan yet. I know one gentleman out in Japan called Peter Ness, who's publishing a PhD, where he's a mining engineer who's interested in space resources, and he's done some work that I hope will help further the understanding of the value of minerals. Because when you build a mine on Earth, on planet Earth, most of the platinum is mined in South Africa, for example, at a place called the Bushveld Complex. So 80% of the world's platinum comes from that one mining complex today. And there are a group of experts in the world called mining engineers, and they know how to do assays, right? And they measure the cost. It depends on the concentration of the mineral and where it is and what the market conditions are. And, Guy was saying, you have to have millions of tons in trucks to come up with just a few pounds of the resource sometimes. And it's a fairly complicated set of calculations to figure out if that's really going to make a profit or not. And so far, nobody's really done that for the moon. And I'm not an expert in that. And we need to get more mining engineers to start running those numbers and coming up with some specific business models. And like I say, I know Peter Ness in Japan is doing, he's doing some of that kind of analysis. I'm glad that he is. But I think he's done that. But, that's the kind of thing where he's done it entirely on his own initiative. I mean, he's a PhD. I think he's at the University of Tokyo, the PhD candidate. So it's kind of being pursued in academia. And I know some of the people at the doing with these asteroid mining companies, they also understand those numbers as well. They're beginning to do the right kind of calculations. But I went to the International Space Development Conference in San Diego last May, and I met some of these asteroid guys, and I was having debates with them, and telling them, why don't you do these calculations on the moon? We can get the resources much faster, but.
They're asteroid guys.
Yeah, it's like they're in love with the asteroids. They're like emotionally invested in asteroids.
It's like messing with somebody's belief system, isn't it?
Which project is is the darling of the day? You know what I mean? So that's what everybody talks about. It's like anything in academia, you have, different theories that come up and are just blown off. The whole thing with the meteor hitting the Earth and all that was ridiculed for years. There's been many, many other instances of that. And,
Chelyabinsk meteor over in Russia for injured 1,000 people. Interesting. I don't know if you saw the video of that.
Yeah, I've seen
that.
That
was a few megatons of energy that got exploded.
Yeah, that was like the size of a basketball or something like that. One day it was people just don't understand. I've talked to people about the Tunguska event and that sort of thing, and there's no crater. There's no.
That was Tesla technology.
Oh, don't even get me started. And I'm like, listen, even Constantine, he saw this sign in the sky that before he went to retake Rome, he saw as a sign from God, and that ancient aliens say it was a spaceship or whatever. But it was an airburst, just like what happened in Russia, but a lot bigger. In fact, it destroyed some temples and stuff like that on the ground. And there's a town like 60 miles away that has a whole oral history and a small little regional war, civil war that broke out because of this event. The pagans started converting to Christianity. And the Christians, the pagans went after the Christians, and they started bonding and killing each other. And there's all sorts of stuff that they found that corroborates this. And you know, Constantine, they had no idea what to make of that. If, when they saw things like that, it was all came from God. You know what I mean? So
yeah,
there have been lots of airbursts.
We've only got 3 minutes, and I want to hand them over to Charles to just let us know where we can get in touch with him, etc. And, you know, if there's any more news or anything, Charles, if you ever want to come back on again, you're more than welcome. You've been
thanks.
A great guest.
Very kind of you. Yeah, it's fun. Like I said, I'm on Facebook, I'm on LinkedIn. I can give an email address, which is charles@aba.st, charles@alphavictoralpha.sugartango. That's it. There's no .com.
Okay.
Feel free to send me an email, and you'll find me. I do like Facebook. I have a Twitter account, but I hardly ever use it. I do like Facebook groups. I'm an administrator of several Facebook groups and pages related to space. We've got, I think David has a helium-3 mining group, which is an excellent group. I also run a space-based solar power group on Facebook, which has 3,600 members currently.
Wow.
Which we've built up over the years. Lima Space Foundation, we have a group on Facebook, and so does Liftport Group. There's another group called the Moon Society, which I'm a member of as well, which also believes in lunar development.
Gotta get some lobbyists.
Yeah,
yes, if anybody wants to join any of these groups, I think it's, you know, it's...
Or if anybody wants to get their hands in their pocket and give you some money, of course.
Donations will be gratefully received. Leeward Space Foundation, is a 501c3 tax-exempt organization. So if you're a United States taxpayer, you can deduct it from your taxes. Unfortunately, if you're a taxpayer in a different country, we are not set up in any other country currently. But that's Leeward, is spelled LWEWARD, Leeward Space Foundation. Also, if you're a U.S. resident, you know, the Leeward has various promotional programs. They've got a credit card with Capital One credit cards where all you have to do is sign up for the credit card. It doesn't cost anything. It's free. And then if you charge anything, if you, like, just buy a cup of coffee or something at Starbucks, if you do that, then Leeward Space Foundation gets $50. So, and then you just pay it, and then you don't have to use the card again if you don't want to, and just pay it off. But if you do continue to use the card, then 2% of whatever you spend is donated to Leeward Space Foundation. So that's just a nice little, I would encourage anybody in the U.S. to do that.
Well, I think it's about time somebody sort of speculated to accumulate, because whatever the means, it sounds like we need to get up there, and we need to get up there fast, and we need these resources. So, well, thanks ever so much for being a guest, Charles. You've been great.
Okay.
Very informative.
Thanks.
I've really enjoyed it.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Thanks.
And thank you very much.
All right. Yeah, we'll keep the faith. Keep pushing it forward.
Oh, we will, always.
Okay. Take care.
All right, sir. Thank you.
Bye. Bye-bye.
So I think, I've gone a massive echo. Right, I don't know who our next guest is. It might just be me and Guy brain farting, so who knows. But I don't know about you, Guy, but I've had a great time.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It was good to get back in the saddle.
Yep.
You know, this infection's finally going away. I mean, it's just a whole lot of things that have been going on, and you know, so.
Well, I've had like the kids on the summer break rampaging, lots of colds, snotty noses, and that's just me.
Yeah.
Had a seven nervous breakdowns there at the back now, and so am I, and so are you. So, I'm looking forward to our future. We've only just become 1 year old.
we gotta do some stuff for Joe. We still gotta do 30-minute spots and banners and all that stuff. So.
Oh, and jingles and all that stuff. Oh my God, are we growing up, Guy?
Oh my God.
Oh my God.
I might actually have to do something.